Before I get started today, I wanted to make sure that I gave a big shout out to Jeannie Coleman Coaching. Jeannie Coleman is a stress and mind-body coach based out of Los Angeles. She spent over 16 years battling fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, and many other TMS symptoms that left her physically and mentally depleted. After healing herself completely, Jeannie is now obsessed with getting her clients fast results through her one-on-one coaching program, which includes weekly support, consistency, and accountability. Perhaps you've done years of therapy, or perhaps you've been working on your childhood and or past traumas and now want a different approach. Maybe it's time for action and a results-driven approach. Instead, one that specifically focuses on TMS and mind-body healing. Working with Jeannie in itself lowers stress because she'll take the overwhelm out of this mountain of TMS info and customize a simple game plan that works best for you and your current lifestyle. How supportive would it feel to have someone in your corner with the experience, results, and confidence in believing you and your healing? I understand it can be scary to reach out for support, but I've known Jeannie for years, and her clients are achieving much more than reducing TMS symptoms. She's a coach dedicated to you thriving in all areas of your life, not just your health. Even if you're nervous or stuck in overthinking, I'd recommend booking a free 45-minute call. It'll be well worth your time, she'll make you feel comfortable, and she's fun to work with. If you're not getting the results that you crave, it's time to step it up. Go to her website and book that free 45-minute call today. That's jeanniecoleman.com. JeannieKulwin.com to learn more. Welcome back to the show. I've been away for a little bit, but I am back, and it is May the 18th, 2023. Welcome back to the podcast. Let me make sure that I give a special shout out to the patrons of the show. If you want to support this podcast and the efforts of it, all 200 and I don't know, 75 or 80 episodes or however many it is that it's in, go to patreon.com/ The Mind and Fitness Podcast to learn more. I'm going to start by going all the way back to the very beginning. Almost 5 years now. It'll be 5 years in November. Barb and Arnie have been supporting the show for a long time. And then a few months later, Sarah and Brian and Julie and Ross and Christina came on board during the early days of the pandemic. Mike and Michael and Tony and Kelly and Irina and Mindy all came along. And then moving on to 2021, Jason, John, Dominic, Enda, Elise, Emily, Kirk, Daniel, Deborah, Julie, Jeff, Albert, Lauren, and Teresa. Thank you all for continuing to support the podcast every single month, week, and year, or years in some cases. So thank you for being here. This week is going to be part one of my interview with Dr. Jeff Axelbank, who's out of New Jersey, and he's a TMS psychotherapist specifically. And it's a really incredible story. And I think that some of the best stories that come from, or best takes that come from a mind-body practitioner, whether it's a coach or a psychotherapist or a medical doctor, are people that have actually gone through it. They've gone through all that. And you'll hear in the beginning of his story, this all began with him having back atrophy and going to get a C-spine MRI and an MRI that showed multiple disc herniations. And then ultimately, how did he unwind out of that and then begin practicing this? So we go over some things that I haven't talked about with TMS therapists before on this show. And a lot of it has to do with the wiring of the brain and being able to think in terms of a three pillars and just being able to use a method that is simple and easy to follow. And I think that you're all thoroughly going to enjoy this. This is part one, so the first half of our conversation runs about an hour, or rather about a half hour for this first one. And then next week, right before the Memorial Day weekend in the United States, you'll hear the second half. So without further ado, here is Dr. Jeff Axelbank out of New Jersey and myself on part one. Welcome back to the Mind and Fitness Podcast. As always, I am your host, Eddie Lindenstein, and it is a real delight to have a psychotherapist back on the line with me. This is Dr. Axelbank calling out of New Jersey. Are you there?
I am.
Do you want me to call you Dr. Axelbank or Jeff, or what would you prefer for this interview?
Jeff would be great.
Okay, cool. All right. Well, I'll go with Jeff. Well, thanks for being here. You know, I found you, it was on a list of TMS resources, that was on the TMS wiki. And so, it's nice to be able to chat with you, today. And I've had a chance to kind of go through your website and such. And I think that going into psychotherapy as a career is incredible. And if I could roll back the clock, that would have been maybe a cool route to go. But I'm curious, you know, the kind of the sub interest there is around chronic pain and chronic illness. And, you know, how did you get into that being a focal point or a focus of your career and of this element of your career?
Yeah, well, it really sprung out of my own personal experience. I was going along sort of fine to some degree, except that I realized in retrospect that really beginning in kind of adolescence, I had a series of episodic back and neck episodes where I would, have a stiff neck and unable to move or turn and be in a lot of pain. And when I was a kid, my mother used to say, it must be that you slept wrong or, you know, your pillow wasn't quite right. That's why this happened. And so, you know, as an adult, I started going to a chiropractor and, you know, a few times a week, and the chiropractor would say that I had subluxations in my back and he would have to do these adjustments. And he warned me that if I didn't do this regularly, it might cause some problems. So I, you know, got into some fairly regular chiropractic work for a while. But I would still have these episodes. And then in fall of 2002, which would be 21 years ago, I had what I call the mother of all back spasms, and it really laid me up, and I was sort of really kind of unable to move, difficulty walking, and then I had what was really kind of a scary thing happen, which was I started having these shooting pains down my arm, and at that point, I went to my doctor, who I love and was a great doctor. And I said, hey, you know, I have this problem. And he asked me to take off my shirt. And I took off my shirt and he looked at my back and he said, oh, you know, your back muscles are already atrophying. I can already see that. So right away, I'm also very, very scared at that point. And he had me go take an MRI. And the MRI, sure enough, showed that in my cervical spine, I had herniated discs and ruptured discs, and the discs were impinging on the nerve that was affecting my arm, and that's why I was having this shooting pain down my arm. And he warned me that I really needed to attend to this because otherwise I would have like a dead arm, and he kind of demonstrated with his arm, like his arm just sort of falling, yeah, falling lifeless. And so he gave me this whole slew of recommendations, go to physical therapy, continue with the chiropractor, go two or three times a week, and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory and muscle relaxant medications, and also warned me to limit my activities because I'm a pretty active guy. And I was riding a bicycle, which meant like sort of leaning over the handlebars and my neck straining, and I was swimming. And, you know, when you do the crawl, your neck is going back and forth. And if you're doing the breaststroke, your neck is craning. And so I shouldn't do all those things. And I should probably not run because that would put, jarring on the spine. And so I did all these things, yeah, and it didn't really help. And so I was kind of unhappy and thinking, oh, well, I guess, I don't know, is this the way it's going to be? And then I get this phone call from my sister-in-law who said, hey, Jeff, you know, how are you doing? And I was like, well, I guess I'm okay. And she said, well, how can you say you're okay when? And I thought she was going to say, how can you say you're doing okay when, you know, your back is in such pain? But what she said really kind of shocked me. She said, how can you say you're doing okay when your daughter just got diagnosed with type 1 diabetes? And I was sort of speechless for a moment. And I was like, what does that have to do with anything? And I mean, she wasn't making it up. My daughter had been diagnosed with type 1 diabetes like a month or two earlier. And she said, you know, this is probably related to why you're in this pain. And I was like, how could that be? I have the MRI. I could show you the picture, you know, that shows the herniated and ruptured discs. And she sent me these books. She sent me John Sarno's book, Healing Back Pain, and also sent me the Mind-Body Prescription. And I started reading them. And at first, I was kind of disbelieving. But then I started to sort of notice some things. I noticed, first of all, that the pain was not constant, that it would sort of wax and wane. And I started to notice patterns, that it kind of varied depending maybe what I was thinking about. And I was in therapy at the time and noticed that the pain would come and go depending what I was talking about in therapy. And it started to make some sense what Sarno was saying. And so I started to take his advice. He talks about what I call the three pillars of Sarno's approach, which is the first pillar is think psychological, not physical. So in other words, it's what's happening in your life, not and what's going on for you emotionally, rather than how you lifted or how you slept or how you turned or how you bent down. And so I was doing that. I started to notice these things. I certainly had this thing in my family with my daughter getting this chronic illness diagnosis. And then he also said to stop all the medical treatments. And that was a kind of hard one and kind of scary because of the pain that I was afraid would happen if I stopped taking the anti-inflammatories and the muscle relaxers. But I stopped slowly, like one at a time, like the physical therapy and the chiropractor and then the medications one at a time. And as I did it, I found it didn't get worse. And then the third pillar is to resume normal activities as soon as possible. And so the first thing I did was I tried to get back in the pool swimming. And Sarno says that, you know, the pain is a distraction from things you don't want to feel or think about. Predominantly, he says anger. And so he encourages people to kind of get in touch with their anger and even yell a little bit. So I dove into the pool that first time and I was in excruciating pain, actually. But I, you know, swimming underwater, started yelling, you know, boo, 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 you know, with bubbles coming up. But I was yelling about how angry I was at the unfairness of my daughter, who was 10 years old at the time, getting this terrible, terrible diagnosis. And when I got out of the pool, I felt a little bit better. It didn't hurt quite as much. And the next time I got in the pool, it hurt less. And basically, over 2 weeks, I became totally and completely pain-free.
Did you share this with your, because the period of time between, you know, you see your doctor and he mentions the back atrophy, and I want to come back to that maybe in a little while too, but mentions about the back atrophy, you get the results of the C-spine MRI, your sister makes a recommendation, you start doing all these things, the three pillars. Did you go back to the doctor after that and say, hey, there's this book that I read, or like, did you do any of that? Talk to the doctor?
I did actually. And I think it became something that he and I couldn't really talk about. And I found out later why, but before I go there, he had a poster in his office, like the sources of lower back pain or back and neck pain. Yeah. And it was all this stuff about, you know, the spine and this and that. And I commented to him, you know, there's one thing that's missing from this. And he said, what? And he said, the brain. And he really, he kind of objected. And he said, no, these are the real thing that I told them about, you know, my experience. And And he said, well, you know, that, I don't know. He'd really kind of dismissed it. And I only found out later that he had a back problem and was in some pain. So I think there might have been some personal reason why he couldn't really, you know, entertain it.
Yeah.
But I also have heard from, you know, patients of mine that their doctors just don't get it really, or don't want to get it, or it's just beyond their ability to willingness to consider mind-body influences.
Interesting. Yeah, because I'd be really curious, and maybe you did learn this later on, but like, back atrophy is a thing. However, we also know that based on data that like Sarno has put in his books, there doesn't necessarily seem to be as much of a correlation between what's found on imaging and what pain somebody has. Meaning you could see a problem that occurs on the left side of an MRI, but the person has symptoms on the right, which doesn't, it just doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. So I was kind of curious on what did he have to say about the back atrophy? Because then you were getting back to activities and doing all the things that you were doing before.
Well, I think, you know, I don't know, of course, but I believe that my guess is that the back atrophy was because I had stopped doing anything. So, yeah, if you stop doing stuff, your back muscles are going to start to atrophy. Now, what? I don't know. I don't have a mirror in the back of my back to really see what it actually looked like.
Yeah.
So I don't really know what he was seeing, but I'm no longer concerned about that.
When your sister had called you, like, what period of time are we talking about? Were you a practicing psychotherapist at this point in time, or was this like while you were through training? You were. Okay. So
I had already been working as a therapist for about 10 years at that point. And in fact, you know, I have a kind of a cushy chair that I sit in, like a kind of maybe a typical therapist chair.
Yeah.
And during the time of this episode, I switched the chairs around in my office so that I had one of those hard, you know, hard back chairs because it was too painful to be sitting in that chair. And in fact, I mentioned that to my sister-in-law. By the way, it's my sister-in-law, not my sister. She said, "Oh, I'll bet you're thinking the reason why your back hurts so much at work is that you're probably thinking about your patients. Yeah, you think you've got problems." I don't know to the degree that was true, but So, and let me just say, once I became pain-free, I've switched the chairs back, and I've been using the cushy therapist chair ever since.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because when my therapist retired in 2018, I managed to pry his therapist chair off of him when he was leaving his office, and he let me have it. I can attune. It is a comfortable chair. So, I've got a nice therapist chair, which is great. How much of this, you know, you go through, like, I don't know, whatever the typical schooling would be for somebody to become a practicing licensed psychotherapist. Do you learn about, like, what was the stuff that was in those books? Was it a foreign concept to you? Like, was it hard to believe? I would assume that somebody in your role, it would be easier to believe and grasp than maybe somebody that has no prior knowledge or concept of psychotherapy. But I could be totally off on that. I'd be curious to get your perspective.
That's a really good question. And I have to think about it a little bit. You know, mind-body phenomena has definitely been in the psychoanalytic literature for, you know, 100 years, probably. In fact, Sarno, in one of the chapters, or maybe it's the appendix of his book, Healing Back Pain, he does go through the kind of historical roots of his approach. And it does go way, way back. But I will say, in my training to be a psychologist, 5 years of grad school, it was not really focused on. And when I talk to even now, so I run a consultation group for other therapists doing this work. And it's hard to get therapists, psychologists, social workers to buy into this, in my experience. Although once they've seen it in action, than they do buy into it. But there's a lot of therapists who, you know, say, you know, I'm on a number of listservs, and they'll say, hey, you know, I've got a patient who's got, you know, chronic back pain or sciatica, and does anyone, you know, specialize in that, as if somehow what they're doing, that they couldn't do it themselves.
Yeah.
But I think they can't do it themselves because they weren't really trained, and they don't really have their eyes open to it.
Now, on your your website, it seems like, and I could be totally off on this, this is just the navigation where I was going into, okay, the therapy that's provided, and there is quite a there's quite a bit of talk around, at least in this the initial section, around survivors of childhood trauma and abuse. Now, I had told you before I started rolling that a lot of the information, when I have experts that come on and talk, a lot of the stuff that we talk about is around what's going on in the now, you know, the new baby, the new job, the new house payment, the new, you know, those kinds of things. What I haven't dove into much with therapists that I've had on in the past is survivors of childhood trauma and abuse, like those conversations. And so I would love to get some of your perspective around that. I know that in Sarno's books, he talked about it, and I feel like because I've read all four, and I feel like as time went on and he was writing more and more, he started to lean more into that, the childhood trauma portion, meaning I feel like in the first book, didn't really talk much about it. Second one, not really much. And then third one, a little more. And then fourth one, I feel like there was a lot more in The Divided Mind where he was speaking about it. So I would love to get the impact of childhood trauma. And then, you know, 30 years later, somebody develops back pain, or they develop acne or weight gain or like whatever, because everybody's symptom seems to be a little bit different. I'd love to get some of your take on that.
Yeah, well, you know, it's not only Sarno, I think, who has become more, or became more, attuned to the impact of childhood trauma, because I think that's really in the whole field, that we've just become more aware of what happens in the wiring of the brain when a person, especially a young person, is exposed to a trauma. It does change the wiring of the brain. And so I think it's not just Sarno who became more aware of it. I think it's throughout the field. But in my mind, so, you know, you mentioned, you know, contemporary stresses. And of course, for me, the contemporary stress was my daughter getting diagnosed with type 1 diabetes.
Yeah.
And so I guess in my mind, and when I work with patients, it's how does the current stress have an echo of or a resonance to something that has been lurking in the background? And it may be a direct connection, and I could cite a couple of examples of that.
Please do, yeah.
In my patients. But it also could be that what the trauma taught you is to how not to feel. And so it may be a more general issue about the trauma sort of taught you how to dissociate your feelings and to turn them off. And then that, when there's a contemporary stress, that taxes you in a way that, because you've learned not to feel, then the feeling, the upset feeling, the anger, the hurt, sadness, the conflict comes out through your body, because
yeah.
you never really learned how to do that. So that's, I think, you know, the two possible ways that childhood trauma can affect someone, but it would be triggered by something that's happening, you know, here and now. You know, I refer to, you know, examples where something is an echo of or a resonance of a childhood experience. I'm thinking about this one person I worked with, who I'm gonna change some things because I always want to protect people's anonymity and
For sure.
Confidentiality. But there was this guy who had a terrible, terrible, debilitating back pain after his kid was born. And it really affected his ability to take care of the kid. He just, you know, couldn't act as a father. He couldn't hold his baby. He couldn't, you know, bend over to change a diaper. It was all this very practical things that were affected. And in working with him, I asked him, you know, well, how did you feel about having a baby? And he said, oh, no, you know, I love my kid. And I said, well, you know, it's kind of, you know, it disrupted your life. You know, you had a great marriage, and now, you know, you and your wife are have this, you know, third party, you know, interfering between the two of you. And what about, you know, you must have, you know, anger at having a baby that, you know, might make you angry.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, no, I love my child. And I said, well, that's why you're in pain. Because you're not letting yourself feel this other side. And of course, he was at first sort of almost insulted that I would intimate that maybe he might be angry at his baby. But the connection to his childhood was that he wasn't adequately taken care of as a child. And so there was certainly, on an unconscious level and a very deep level, a resentment that now he, who hadn't been taken care of, now he has to take care of someone else. And when he got in touch with that, with the hurt, and of course also the anger, which he couldn't feel as a child, about his own neglect, his own emotional neglect that he felt, growing up, only then could he be in touch with, you know, why he might be angry with having to take care of another human, and the pain went away.
And then he was able
to do all the parenting things.
Do you find that in a situation like that, maybe not that exact one, but situations that are like that, because I'm sure that's, I mean, I hate to say, but it's probably fairly common, something like that. Do you tend to find that, memories of neglect or things like that? Sarno talked a lot about repression. And when mm-hmm. I think of repression, I think of the inability to remember, details or whatever, like it's totally blocked out. Do you find that to be the case? Like, is there a lot of prying or how do you get somebody to speak about things that maybe they haven't wanted to talk about in 30 years?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I also this is maybe too technical, I don't know, but there's a difference between repression and dissociation.
Okay.
So repression is like repressing a memory, keeping something down. If you think about a kind of keeping it underwater, and dissociation is more compartmentalizing. The most extreme version of dissociation is multiple personality, where you actually have like a kind of rather than a horizontal pushing something down, you have a kind of vertical pushing something off to one side.
Yeah.
And so there's a kind of a difference in that. But I think the main challenge of therapy is to really move at a pace that the patient can tolerate. And patients often come and say, well, how long is this going to take? And it's an impossible question to answer because it kind of depends how brave they are on one hand, which seems like a kind of conscious thing, but also just how much they need to protect themselves from some very, very upsetting things. And my sense is that it sort of depends how bad the trauma was. And some people, it takes a very long time. It doesn't mean it can't be done, but it does require some patience. And especially in the case of abuse, where one of the hallmarks of abuse is not being in control and not being able to have any power. If I start pressuring and coercing someone to face something they're not ready to, that can then become a re-traumatizing experience itself. So I always say, you know, we have to do this at a pace where you are comfortable. And if we start going too fast, first of all, let me know. And second of all, if I see signs that maybe, you know, your walls are going up because we're moving too fast, then we have to back off a little bit.
And to make sure that I'm understanding that right, are you saying like you're working with somebody, you're not necessarily pushing too far, but you're, maybe that is the right term, that it almost like destabilizes the patient?
It can. Okay. It can, or it becomes counterproductive in the sense that, you know, you're ultimately you want to sort of reduce the defenses. But if you start sort of going too fast, too far, too deeply, that may actually increase the defenses. And so when you see that happening, you know, it sort of reminds me of this. I use this little story with my patients. There's a story of the Zen student going to the Zen master and saying, you know, how long is it going to take to get to enlightenment? And the Zen master says, oh, you know, it usually takes maybe 5 years. And the student says, well, what if I really like try harder? And the Zen master says, well, in that case, it'll probably take about 20 years. And wow, I think that captures it. You know, it's like if you try to push too hard, it actually will make it take longer.
You almost get like a reflex effect, basically, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thanks.
It's kind of like, you know, a cornered animal. Like if you want to tame a horse, for instance, you know, you can't corner them. You know, you have to make them come out of their corner, lure them out. You have to do it in a kind of a way that's more caring than attacking.
I coach girls soccer for 7, 8. And 9 year olds, and it's some of that actually sounds kind of familiar what you're talking about in terms of trying to get them on board or buy into the things I want them to do and approaching it a little bit differently.
Exactly.
That's just coming to mind. Well, that's interesting stuff. So you had mentioned